My name is Roland Emmetott. Most people call me M. In the incident management team I'm on, they call me Mr. M. Okay? And I represent the Northwest Weather and Avalanche Center, which is a Forest Service operation. And there's three forecasters that are located in the Weather Service Forecast Office in Seattle. They're Forest Service employees. One of them forecasts per day because they work 7 days a week. So there's only one forecaster working at a time. And that forecaster is forecasting for an area about the size of Switzerland. From the Canadian border all the way down to Mount Hood, both sides of the Washington Cascades, and the Olympics. In Switzerland, they probably have 200 or 300 forecasters forecasting for the same area. So, with that information, when you look at this forecast, you know, it's pretty general. So it's really important. You use the information in the forecast, but you've got to make a lot of your own judgments and tests when you're out there. And I also represent the Friends of the Northwest Weather and Avalanche Center, which is a nonprofit organization which helps keep the center alive because, like all other government operations, they're struggling for funding and they seem to pick on the little organizations that have very little money rather than the big operations. So we're always struggling to stay alive. I'm going to do a quick review, and I neglected to tell you that, and the people, maybe they must have heard about it, the other people are here, because there's a quiz that goes with this presentation. You thought it was a free lunch. There is a quiz. So I don't know what we're going to do with the people that didn't show up this afternoon. They aren't going to get a very good mark in the quiz. But anyhow, I'll do a quick review of some of the things we looked at yesterday. Remember, we said that most accidents are caused by the victim. But you need to think about, you know, you don't want to be set yourself up so you're in the 10%. It's the 10% that are picked off by an avalanche. They don't start the avalanche. And like I mentioned here, at Holden Village and on up Railroad Creek, you could very easily be in the 10% group from a roof avalanche or avalanches coming down either side of the canyon as you travel up Railroad Creek. So you don't want to spend too much time in those 10% areas. Conditions are most unstable when?
The first 12 to 24 hours during the storm or right after?
During the storm or first 12 to 24 hours after the storm. Good. I didn't mention this yesterday, but winds over 15 miles an hour, hazards develop. So if the winds are blowing over 15 miles an hour on the ridgetops, it's building danger on the lee slopes. Another thing, remember we talked about you need to understand and be able to identify windward and leeward slopes. Now we understand a little bit what windward is. That's the side the wind of the ridge that the wind is hitting. The leeward side is where the snow is being deposited. Okay? Remember I gave you some clues of how to figure out which way the wind was blowing. Remember the flags? Mm-hmm. Remember I said, I think the meteorologists call them snow scoops or something like that, but I call them flags. We'll see more examples. Remember Rhyme? We talked about Rhyme. We missed figuring out which way the wind was blowing with Rhyme miserably, but now everyone should have it perfect. Okay, a little bit of an update. What I do every morning when I'm in the mountains, and you probably could do it here, I did it this morning. I walked out the door and walked over to the, what do you call them, main building?
Dining hall or hotel.
The hotel.
Yes.
And I stopped, first of all, I looked at the sky. It's clear. So that's something to look at when you walk out there, look at the sky. Then I noticed been no precipitation overnight. Then as I walked into the dining hall, hotel, I looked at the temperature. It was 35 degrees. And the wind, and then the wind was blowing. I noticed that too. And I looked, I had a little barometer in my room, I had a little barometer, and the pressure had been rising overnight. So anyhow, there were some interesting things. What I concluded, one thing I concluded was clear night, rime can develop. But what happened? What was happening?
Wind.
Wind was blowing. So rime doesn't form when the wind blows. I noticed, well, no new precipitation, so I wasn't concerned about that. Clear sky, well, the sun's going to come out. It's fairly mild. We might be concerned about sun hitting the south-facing slopes, these slopes over here. And remember I showed the snowflakes that are rounded, and when they get warmer, you have meltwater between the flakes. And so potentially the south-facing slopes maybe would be a little more of concern today, especially since the temperature stayed warm overnight. Once the wind stopped this morning, the temperature dropped. It dropped down below freezing. It's sort of an interesting little event that happened overnight. So be observant when you get up in the morning in the mountains. Okay, another thing that is just interesting, maybe you've heard this book, The Snow Sense, which I'm going to give the village the new version, had an interesting little paragraph, and maybe it's about a fable, maybe you've heard it before, I never had. It's a fable about four blind men in India who, you heard, who came upon an elephant. You've heard it?
No,
yeah, so maybe I don't, everyone else heard it?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I never heard. Anyhow, four blind men came upon an elephant when traveling in the forest. Unfamiliar with such an animal, each man set about trying to examine and determine the nature of the beast. One man touched a leg and resolved that the elephant resembled a tree trunk. Another man felt the tail and had no doubt that the animal was shaped like a rope. The third man stood by the ear, and as it flapped back and forth, and concluded that the creature was much like a fan. The fourth man felt his way around the entire body and decided the elephant was something enormous, almost without beginning or end. So the tale is unlike the situation in the backcountry. Traveler faces attempting to evaluate potential avalanche hazard. With incomplete examination of available data, often erroneous conclusions result. So, when you get this book, you can read it. You didn't, when you heard it before, you didn't apply it to
avalanche.
No. That was trunk and snake, too, in your finger.
Okay. So we're gonna have to fast forward here, get where we were. Okay, equipment. There's four items you should take with you. If you're gonna go in the backcountry and ski or snowshoe or slide on steeper slopes. One is an avalanche beacon. There are different types of rescue devices. These are designed for party rescue. You know, if you're buried in an avalanche after 30 minutes, only 50-50 chance of survival. Some of the other devices that you've probably read about, Spot and some others, are designed if you're lost in the backcountry. Search parties have devices to track those. These are not the same item. These are for party search and rescue. So if your party member's buried, immediately, everyone wears a beacon, and they're all on transmit mode. If someone gets buried, you immediately put it on proceed mode, and then you start searching. And they've saved many lives. You can come in and sing.
We're just looking for our mom.
Oh, I don't know your mom.
She's going to give her these, yeah.
Yeah. Does she have an avalanche beacon on?
No.
No? So, anyone had experience with one of these? Okay. There's a beacon buried in the room. Go find it. So, the second piece of equipment you should have is a probe. So, once you're in the general area of where the beacon is buried, sometimes it's faster to find the victim with a burp hole.
Ouch, ouch.
And yeah, you say, Al, a lot of people worried about, oh, here's puncture wound. Well, puncture wound is not as bad as death.
Try it in the piano.
Yes, I know.
Is it in the piano?
Lift up the lid.
You're close enough. You got it. Good job. He went right to it. So, you probably should get a little dry.
Oh.
How about a spork?
Yay!
What's your favorite color?
Blue is actually my favorite color.
Well, that's as close as I can get.
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Good job. See? So, pretty effective. Tomorrow, well, good job. You put it back in transmit mode.
Mm-hmm.
See?
In case the avalanche were to come.
So, tomorrow we'll practice with these, but you got a pretty good feeling how effective they are in finding a buried victim. They're a lot more user-friendly than they used to be. Okay. And then, sometimes people don't have beacons, or they aren't on transmit mode, so your only other alternative, other than clues like a hand sticking out of the snow or part of the clothing or a pack, otherwise all you got is a probe to probe. And people say, well, if I got my tent along, can I use my tent poles? Not very effective. These probes are made out of aircraft aluminum. The tent poles are made out of much cheaper aluminum, and it'll break or bend, pushing it down through avalanche snow. Avalanche snow is heavy, very heavy. So third piece of equipment is a shovel, and there's different sizes. This is about the right size shovel one should have. Earlier days, there were shovels made out of plastic, and some were made out of Lexan. I wouldn't buy either one. And if you got plastic or Lexan shovels, I'd get rid of them, use them for something else, because in heavy avalanche snow, they'll either fracture or break, not very effective. And an oval handle is stronger than a round handle. So if you're purchasing new ones, look at shovels with oval handles rather than round handles. Okay, so what's the fourth piece of equipment you should carry with you?
Water bottle.
Yeah, but that's good to carry, but that's not the critical
snow
item.
Snow saw?
The what?
A snow saw?
No.
Whistle?
What?
Whistle?
No. Well, they're all good, but the important one is...
Oh! Sleeping?
What is that?
Brain.
Brain.
Ah, oh, brain, brain. Good.
We could pass it around.
I need one.
So, anyhow, carry your brain with you. All right. I carry other pieces of equipment, but those are the four critical items. So we talked about the beacons. There's various different manufacturers. I gave Brent some write-ups on different types of beacons. If anyone's interested, I got a few more copies, so let me know afterwards. They're all on the same frequency. So if you buy one in New Zealand, Switzerland, or in the United States or Canada, they're all on the same frequency, so they all work with each other. There's four or five, six different brands. And they all have the same frequency. And you know, the business with the beacon makers is very competitive, so every couple of years they come out with a little better beacon. And they're, you know, they aren't inexpensive. They're $200 to $400 a piece. But what's a life worth? And that's something that apparently a life is worth somewhere between 3.5 and 8.4 million. So a life is worth a lot. Okay. So, beacons. First of all, this person is not wearing his beacon properly. It's important to wear your beacon inside your clothing, inside your parka. Whoops. Because if you're caught in an avalanche, it can be ripped off. So wear it inside your parka or inside your fleece jacket. And I don't recommend climbing skins in avalanche country because if you have your skins on and you release an avalanche, it really slows you down trying to get away from the avalanche. Okay. So you can use these tools for other things. I think it's really important with your either your ski pole or your probe to poke holes in the snow a lot. You can identify weak layers. If you poke your probe down into the snow and you have constant resistance against that probe, that's an indication of stable snow. But if you push it down and it drops a foot, wow, there's significant weakness in the snowpack. And you can pick up some of those rain crusts and sun crust down there. So, very useful tool. And you can use your shovel for stability tests. And we already have a volunteer. What was her name?
Katie.
Katie to be a snow caller. So, and Katie's going to have to stand out in front of the room. And we'll practice, we'll do this tomorrow in real snow. Me stand right there. I could, well, we need to look at this for a little bit. This is a professor from the University of Calgary. He developed the shovel compression test, but he's doing it improperly, in my opinion. But he invented it, he did all the research, and there's been a lot of work, and there's another test that we'll demonstrate as well. Okay, so essentially there's three quick tests that you should do out there with a shovel. One, the first one is the shovel shear. Okay, so Katie, gonna get out here. And I'm going to turn out. So she's just a mass of snow. So what we're going to first do is we're going to make about a 4-foot wall So, now, Katie is part of this 4-foot wall. Now, the first test, like I said, is going to be the shovel shear. So with the shovel shear, we're going to isolate a column. It's about 30 centimeters, roughly a square, 30 centimeters square, roughly the size of the shovel. I mark it on top of the snow, so I got a feeling of where I'm going to cut it. So we're going to isolate this column. And for the shovel shear, the backside, we only go partway down, so about halfway down. And then we stop, okay? Then we put the shovel back, down the back, and then we pull on it, okay? And if we have failure, it will identify a weak layer in the snowpack. And I went out there this morning and did the shovel shear, and boy, immediately I got failure. And it was on the, whenever you had the rain event, the big rain event, and months ago.
We've had two, one a couple of weeks ago, and then
It was much earlier.
Yeah.
It failed on that December rain. Anyhow, December rain crest, that's where the failure was. And then I had a second failure. I did that, and then I continued down what below where it failed. And then I'd fail right on the ground. There's not, the ground layer, there must have been faceted crystals that disappeared, and there's nothing. There's a space. So there's two weaknesses. Well, but this does not tell me what I need to know if I want to go out there and ski. All it did was identify there's some weaknesses in the snowpack. It doesn't tell me if I go out there on my skis or snowshoes, if my weight will stress the snowpack and will have failure on those weaknesses. Okay? It identifies the weaknesses, but don't get all concerned if you have failure, because it's only telling you a little bit of the story. So, the second test is the shovel compression test, the one we saw in the photo here. And that, in that one, we do the same thing, but in that one, we isolate the column all the way down the backside. So we have a column that's no longer attached to the rest of the snowpack. And if we have failure, without even putting any more stress on it, it's already stressed because it's no longer attached to the rest of the snowpack. If we have failure then, if Katie's head just drops off, so we got a foot of snow that just falls off. You know, things are pretty touchy out there. But if not, we're gonna put some stress on the column. And I'll be gentle. Sort of. So, the way I was taught, and this was by some Canadian folks, I was taught to, first of all, you want to make the top of that column flat. You want, when you put stress on the column, you want to have it flat so you can get good stress going right down the column. You don't want it sideways, okay? So, we flattened the column, top, and then the first level of putting stresses on is 5 taps from the wrist. 2, 3, 4. You feel stress, Lou?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I see. See, we can see the amount of stress we're putting on the column by Katie's face. So, anywhere, we do 10 taps from the wrist. And if we have failure with 10 taps from the wrist, things are pretty touchy out there. Remember, this is just one piece of information. It isn't the silver bullet. Okay? All right. So, we did 10 taps on the wrist. No failure. So, the next level is 10 taps from the elbow. Or 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Okay, so we do that to 20. So if we have failure, moderately unstable. If no failure, then, and I'm not going to do it, then we do 10 taps from the shoulder. Okay? Now, the reason I was instructed, and I believe putting your arm on the handle, it equalizes the stress I put on it versus the stress you put on it or you put on it. And so there's a good comparison between if I'm doing it here at the village and someone else is doing it up at Heart Lake or Copper Basin. You won't see anyone else probably doing it that way. But I believe that's the way it should be done. So, thank you, Katie, for being a wonderful snow column. She should get a hand in it. You got a choice.
Swag.
Yellow or black?
Yellow. Gracias.
You're welcome. Yay. Oh! We'll have you come up, and you got to bring three friends.
One.
But not quite yet. So, the third test, that's called, the first one was the shovel shear, the second was the shovel compression test, and the third one is the extended column test. And we're going to see a video of it here, and then we'll quickly demonstrate it. And so, with the shovel compression, the information we got, first of all, we had failure. And second of all, we had a feeling of how much stress we put on the snow to have that failure occur. We didn't get that information with the shovel shear. Now, we want to really find out, is that failure, that crack that's going to occur, is it going to propagate across the slope? That's what's scary. Mm-hmm. That's what causes the huge slab avalanche that we saw earlier in the presentation. Mm-hmm. So, and we do it the same way. We isolate a column, but it's 30 centimeters by 90 centimeters. So essentially three shovel lengths. So here it is. Here's what we're doing. See, he's doing it improperly, but it's all right. So. He had failure on about, what?
14.
Five on the, from the elbow. We don't need to have, we won't. Everyone follow how we did it? That's, we'll practice that tomorrow. So we don't need to bring two more people up with Katie and hit Katie some more in the top of the head. Okay, very effective. And this one tells you, you have failure, and then it shows that the crack propagated across the slope. Sometimes you have failure, but no propagation, so conditions aren't quite as much of concern. Any questions about that? It's very effective test, and you guys here at Holden should be doing this every once in a while. Just get a feeling. And you don't do this test out in the middle of a slope, an avalanche slope. You want to do it in the same elevation and the same exposure, you know, windward, leeward slope that you're traveling on. And you don't have to do it on the slope. You can get the same information. They've done a lot of research and testing, and you can do it on flat ground and still get the same information. So don't test yourself by going up on the slope to do it. But you want to do it in the general area you're going on. And if you, you know, if you gain 500 or 1,000 feet, do it again. If you change your exposure, do it again. But it's very quick, it's easy to do. Another test that's done is called a Ruch block. It was done, developed in Switzerland, is where you isolate a block of snow, the width of your length of your skis, the width of your ski pole. It takes a long time to do. It's effective. You then you get on it with your skis, and then you put them down, and you get a pretty good feeling of stability. But it takes a long time to do. So, groups go out there, they do one of these, and they don't do any more. And it's important to do these tests often. So that's why I like the other ones. And this is where they did a bunch of Ruch blocks on a slope. Ruch block 1 is very unstable. Ruch block 5 is very stable. So you can see you can get the differences on the same slope. And one way you can get differences is if you're near the edge of a tree area. And I think it was mentioned in the film last night, and I've seen it happen. The surface hoar that's formed on clear, quiet nights won't form close to the trees because it's somewhat shaded, so the process doesn't happen. Also, trees produce heat, and the surface hoar won't form because it's a little warmer close to the trees. Okay, so look at the snowflakes when they're falling. If they look like the beautiful stellars you see here, it's an indication of no wind. Sometimes you're down here and the wind can be howling on the ridge tops, but maybe you don't see it or hear it. But if you see snowflakes like this, it's an indication of very little wind. If the snowflakes look like needles or slivers, even though you don't hear any wind, the wind is blowing and breaking down the crystals and transporting the snow. If the snow looks like ball bearings or BBs, that's called grapple. They're rind snow crystals. And they have a tendency to fall and roll down a slope and sit in indentations on the slope or at the bottom of cliffs, so that could produce the weak layer in the snowpack. This is an incident that actually occurred a number of years ago on the north side of Mount St. Helens before it erupted. I was involved in the rescue. It was a group of students from Lutheran University, I think it was. I think it was Pacific Lutheran. And it was 29 or 30 students and instructors, and they had a mountaineering class, and they came to Mount St. Helens to, it was in May, first part of May. And they're doing crevasse rescue exercises and so on, and they decide to camp because it was a blustery day, blowing snow. So they decide to set up camp, and I think visibility-wise, they really didn't realize where they set up their camp. And right about dusk, there was a natural release. They're in the 10% group. The avalanche came down through their camp. Of the 29 or so, 26 were buried. Of that number, 5 died. And I was involved. I found, and no one had beacons. I was involved with the rescue and found at least several of the of the buried victims. Very unfortunate. And when you see the next photograph, you say, gee, how dumb could they be to camp where they did? But I don't think they didn't realize where they were. They were camped right at this spot, and the avalanche came down the Forsyth Glacier. But I'm not, you know, that's why in rough, bad weather, look for clues. If you got to set up a camp, look for clues. And maybe certain spots you don't want to set up in the camp. Maybe it'd be better to be on a ridge top than a gully. Today you wouldn't have to worry about this spot because it's gone. No mountains and hills erupted. Okay, there's no signs out there saying there's avalanche area ahead, but there's lots of clues. Like I mentioned earlier, in most of the accidents, there are at least four or five clues shouting at the people, but they ignored them, or they saw them and they didn't want to look at them. So, you know, broken limbs on the uphill side of a tree, a good indication that something happened there. In this case, the uphill side of the tree, no limbs at all, and even a little slough came down and plastered the uphill side of the tree. Avalanche debris, pretty good indicator that something happened there. And so that's an area that I would avoid. I wouldn't set up my camp here or eat lunch there. But people have climbed over debris and climbed over some more debris, and then they released the avalanche and got buried in. Don't spend too much time in the wrong spot. You can be in the 10% group.
Gee.
Wow.
Oh.
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 Gee.
Now,
is that a glacier tag?
I don't know. There's a piece of footage that I found, and I figured I really needed it, and there's other pieces to it, someone announcing, but in some other language. Mm-hmm. And I think it happened in Italy. I don't know anything more about it. But the point is, snowmobilers are great at this. They have a sport called high marking. They see whose sled can get higher up. And all the rest of the party are at the bottom watching them. You know, exactly the same thing here. They release an avalanche, and there's been some horrible accidents because people are just sitting at the bottom watching. So also be careful where you're watching the view. This case, is this a slope I'd be concerned about or not?
Not very steep.
Not very steep, right? Anything else?
Is it packed down snow? I can't tell what that is.
Go on.
Is it packed down snow? I can't see what's going on.
It's packed.
It's like it's on the New York side.
It's like it's wind blowing. It's been there a long time.
Been there a long time. Ah, you got it. It's a windward side. All those ripples are wind. So it's a windward slope, not a lee slope. On the lee slope, they're the ones that are dangerous. It's very smooth. That's why the skiers like to ski on the lee slopes, because it's nice and smooth. So it wouldn't be as much fun, but it'd be a lot safer to ski on that one. So, this one, how about this slope? This is a little Annapurna in the Enchantments, south of here, Cascades. I'll tell you, it's, you know, the snowshoe isn't sinking in very deep. So, and we see wind carvings, but there's a much bigger clue, shouting at me at least.
In the background, they were
shouting. It's all rhyme ice. So, unfortunately, you can't see the back side of the rock, but there's no no rye mice on the back side. So what? This is the windward side, the lee side is on the other side. So see, super clue, rhyme is a super clue for figuring out windward lure. In this case, I think this is lee deposition, you know, very, very smooth, not very steep where the skiers are. I'd be more concerned about some of these steeper pitches. The route they're on is okay. I don't like their travel management strategy there. We'll talk about that. Various things are happening in this photo. Rain ruts. You probably see rain ruts around here. Initially, probably it was very unstable, but when I see rain ruts like this, to me, that's an indication the rain is percolating down through the snowpack and pretty well taking care of any weaknesses in the snowpack once you see the ruts. When I took the photo, it was middle of the day, south-facing slope. We had a little bit of snowballing. As long as the snowballs stay small, I'm not too concerned. I'm sure you see it on your road coming up here all the time. You see the little snowballs, and then sometimes you see big rollers like this. I'd be more concerned if I saw these. That means there's more unstable, wet, deeper, wet snow on top. So putting more stress on the snowpack, on the weak layer that's below it. So you see these on the road too, don't you, Brent? See rollers?
Sometimes they make them.
Sometimes pretty big ones? Okay. I'd be more concerned about conditions on south-facing slopes if I saw the big cartwheels. If you're skiing or snowshoeing and cracks shoot out in front of you, pretty good indication that you should turn around, mm-hmm. Right? Okay, this actually took up beyond Heart Lake. And these are settlement cones. A very good indication of very stable snowpack. When I was up here, it was in late winter. It had been mild, warm days, cool nights. The snowpack was settling and forming these settlement cones. Very stable conditions. This is surface horror. You've seen it here. I saw some beautiful surface horror, I don't know, a couple years ago when I was here. And it's no concern now. It's wonderful stuff to ski on. The concern is if it remains cold and snow falls on top of it, this will end up being the weak layer in the snowpack. We heard it in the film last night. That's what was the result of the incident in the film. And most of the fatal accidents here in the western part of the United States are the result of surface horror. And like I said, it's not everywhere out there. It could be on a slope, but not on the ridge top because the wind's blowing on the ridge top. But in the protected areas, it develops and stays. The next day, the sun comes out. Sun hits the south-facing slope. The surface horror disappears, but on the north facing, where the sun doesn't hit, it remains. So it's going to be spotty out there. That's why you need to do these tests continually. Okay? Are you following? These are unusual, huge sun cups. So tough skiing, but very stable snow. Have anyone climbed Mount St. Helens that's in here? No. Well, this is on the climbing route. It was late spring. So, and what do you think about these skiers? Are they, on this particular day, are they in a good spot or a bad spot?
Bad. Bad.
Why?
Because it's a bright, clear sky.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of small trees.
Light or what?
And there's a lot of small trees, too.
Yeah.
In a good spot.
Go what?
In a good spot.
like he said, the small trees are going to hold the snowpack together, and it's mostly flat, and you've got the sunspots, which are an indicator of stable snow.
Wow, both of you is sort of...
It's definitely an avalanche chute. You can see where there's big trees off to the left, and those small trees, they're only small because there hasn't been an avalanche there in the last 5-6 years.
Okay, you got it. But how about on this particular day?
I would say they're safe. The snow looks very stable.
Yeah.
And why does it look stable?
Because you can see sun cups.
Sun cups. Good. Good
and
job.
And they're not sinking in. They're not really sinking in at all.
Hmm?
They're not sinking in.
They aren't sinking. Yeah, another good point. Yes. So, it's not that easy, but you got it. You can see a super clue of it's right square in the middle of an avalanche path. You can't see what's behind you, so I know more than you do.
Yeah.
But there's a steep slope right behind where I took the photo. Middle of winter, I wouldn't camp here. I'd be back in the trees, way back in the trees. But on this particular day, there wasn't hardly any snow behind me on that slope, and we had sun cups, so very stable conditions. So they're okay. On the state. Okay. So, if you're traveling, you know, best go up through the trees, stay off the open slopes, go from island safety to island safety. Watch out around rocks. Because of the temperature gradient, quite often you'll have some of these faceted crystals that develop around the rocks. So there could be weaknesses around the rock.
So is it kind of a risk then? Because you're going underneath it in a straight line, but then you do curve around to the side.
Yeah.
So is that just,
the weaknesses quite often are just right close to the rock. It's not so much that an avalanche will release, but you might drop, sink in quite a ways because of that faceted snow around the rock.
So the guy that died in the movie yesterday, he was under a rock, right?
It was under a rock, but in that case, I think it was different. I think that whole slope that he went out on under that rocky area,
that
surface ore, that was the weakness that slid on, that the snow he was on slid on. So, in avalanche country, I don't think I'd travel. Is this a slope of concern?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's steep enough. Old avalanche debris over here. They're sinking deeply in the snow. It's a lee slope. If you got to go across that slope, you should go one at a time. So, go from island of safety to island of safety, and you watch that person as that person crosses. And if that person releases an avalanche, the person's crossing should yell in case these people aren't looking, because his last seen area is critical for locating the victim. So once that person gets across, is it okay for free-for-all across the slope? No. The 10th, 100th person across us should go one at a time. If you're coming up and you see this track across the slope, would you consider that slope safe? No. You don't know when the track was made and conditions could have changed. People have gotten in and have died because they thought the slope was safe because there was tracks on it. And you also be careful, more people in the mountains, sometimes you have another party above you, and that's, be watching. Again, what did I say, have laser-like focus, but flood-like awareness. So focus on what you're doing out there, but be constantly aware of what's around you. This is sort of a quiz question, but so we got time for the quiz. I'll help you with it. So you're here. It's been a week since we've had any storms come through. Fairly mild temperatures. And you want to get up on the mountain because you want to ski the slope. Probably not too many people here want to ski that slope. But
well, I do.
You do? Okay. So, well, do you want to find a route?
Sure.
So, just press that little
button there.
Yeah. So, you're back there.
I'm right here?
Yep.
I would probably go up right here.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't like these cornices.
No.
There's big shadow in there.
Yeah.
And then it looks like the wind came over this way, deposited snow here.
Yeah, that's correct. You
flags.
Yep.
That looks good there too, though, but you'd want to stay away from the edge there.
Yeah. I think I'd find some openings where I could do a few stability tests the ones we described. I might do one in here. I'd like to do it in an opening so the information that I get is not affected by the trees. Mm-hmm. And then maybe up here I'd do one, maybe up here I'd do one. If you have some friends along, you might want to try to break off a chunk of cornice. Mm-hmm. And kick that off on the slope, and that chunk is a lot heavier than you are, so it put quite a bit of stress on the slope, and you determine whether or not you're going to get an avalanche release. If it releases, I think I'd stay off the slope.
So how would you do that? Would you tie yourself to your friends and have them hold you?
Well, you could belay yourself. You could belay. If you do that, just be careful, because the rope isn't designed to hold you and you wrapped in a ton of snow.
Right.
If you're going to do that, do it very carefully.
Yeah.
So. I think I'd ski it on this particular day. It's been a week since we've had, if I got good information after doing these tests, I've looked at the mountain, the avalanche forecast, and so on. Okay.
I have a question. If you were to do a test, because you were talking about coming up the side and finding a clear spot in the trees on the windward side to do the test.
I'm going to do the test on the lee side.
Okay,
this
I
is all lee.
Because it would give you a different...
Yeah, I do tests somewhere in this area. I think I could do one in there, I might do one in there, I might do one out here, then on up here.
So that curve part, that's still considered?
I think it's all the in here.
Okay.
Once you get up in here, it's getting more, a little more windward. Then, if I'm going to ski it, I probably wouldn't do it today. I've done it in the past, years ago. I think I wouldn't go down the middle of the gully. I'd go down close to the flank. In case it did release, I could get back to the flank. I might go away, stop, maybe do another quick test, and then go. Okay, same mountain. We're looking at this face over here. We're around a little more to the northwest. Recent storm. Look how the flags. Mm-hmm. Look at the flags. See how they stand out. So which way was the wind blowing?
That
way. Right this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we had cross loading. So each one of these gullies is loaded. So I don't think I'd go today. I'd wait for things to stabilize. But see how those flags really stand out and really give you a lot of information. All right. What happened? Where's our victim, our typical victim? He isn't here today.
He's packing.
Hmm?
He's packing.
He's what?
He's not here.
He's not here. What happened to him?
The kids are going out tomorrow. He's packing with them.
Oh, he's packing.
He sends his regrets that he can't be at lunch with them today.
Well, anyhow, what was his name?
Brian.
Brian. Okay, here he is, Brian. So, Brian, you tell him we really harassed him.
I know.
No, Brian skied up, and he's a hot skier. He climbed up, He actually sidestepped all the way up here, and then he went for it. So what do you think about his decision?
It's on the windward side.
Well, it's not that easy.
All those flags are pointing at him.
Hmm?
All the flags are pointing at him.
Flags are pointing at him. Flag here, flag here. So he's, the flags are pointing.
Where are you going?
There's a deposition area right here. It's very subtle. See, there's flag, flag. So the wind is blowing from this direction. This is a little concave area that's filling up. So it's an area of concern. It's a deposition area. It's a lee slope deposition area. There's some other clues.
It's smooth.
Hmm?
It's smooth.
It's smooth, yes, good. That's good.
Off to the right, right down a little ways, right there.
Oh.
That's an avalanche.
Another one up above.
Yeah.
So Brian,
and he could see it from there.
He should have seen that.
Yeah.
And he should have seen the flags when he was going up. Uh-oh.
Oh, there they are.
Too bad, Brian. Okay. So, self-rescue, speed is critical. In most cases, you aren't going to outrun an avalanche. Some snowmobilers think they can. Some have. A powder avalanche has been recorded over 150, almost to 200 miles an hour. So outrunning them probably isn't going to work. So try to get to the flank. Try to get to the edge. Do whatever you can. Fight to get to the edge. If you're carrying real heavy-duty gear, like if you're carrying an 80-pound pack, get rid of it. But a day pack, a light day pack, keep it with you. You can get rid of your skis and poles, yeah, try to get rid of them. You used to talk about swim. There's differences of opinion. I think if you get caught, you really don't have any control on doing anything. But some, you know, just fight to stay on top. Fight to stay on top of the snow. Like it says, a human body is not buoyant in snow, it's buoyant in water. But human bodies, if you've ever, at Christmas time when you get a whole box of nuts,
mm-hmm.
and there's those, the dark...
The Brazil nuts, yeah? The big ones?
Brazil nuts. So you shake it, the Brazil nut will come to the top because it's bigger, it's more mass. So in a lot of cases, the human body caught in avalanche will come to the top, but not always. So do whatever you can do to try to get to the flanks. And if that doesn't work, some people propose if you give up fighting, try to get your arms up around your neck, because once you come to a stop, your arms are close to your face and you can clear a space around your face. But if you're in these swimming motions and you come to a stop and your arms are out here, you aren't going to be able to, the snow sets up like concrete. You aren't going to be able to move. So it helps to have your arms closer to your neck and face so you can clear a space like they have here. What happens very quickly once you use up the oxygen that's in that cavity, you'll go unconscious because the heat from your face will form an ice mask around the opening, the space, and once that ice mask forms, oxygen cannot get through the snow to replenish the oxygen in that space. So you go unconscious. And again, what we're talking about, the rule of threes, 3 minutes without oxygen, you'll die. So things to do for survivors, call 911. We never used to say that, but now in a lot of mountain areas, you have access to cell towers. So try to call 911. Here, staff, you got radio, so you call a village. So make the call. It's easy. It's better to cancel, at least to get the rescue group started, and you might cancel later. A lot of cases, they spent a lot of time trying to locate the victim and gave up, then called the rescue, and by that time, it was too late by the time the rescue group got there. So call or radio or whatever you do to get word to the village here. With your beacons, locate the victim. You can pinpoint the victim quicker using probes once you get the general area with the beacon, extract, and resuscitate. After 30 minutes, only 50-50 chance of survival. Spend time on the most likely spot searching. Also make sure the safe, number one priority is safety of the surviving members. So make sure you can get to where you think the victim is safely. And so this is the last seen area. So in most cases, the victim will be down the fall line from the last seen area. And you're over here, so make sure you can get to the debris area where you can start searching safely. Maybe it's safer to go around from the bottom than crossing this slope, because you already had one release and you might have another one. So search around trees, look for skis, gloves, search in the flat area and at the debris at the runout zone directly down the fall line from the last seen area. And then do the beacon search. Again, don't get so programmed on that beacon that you miss a hand sticking out of the snow. It's happened. Also, make sure that everyone turns off their beacons off of transmit mode onto receive mode. Invariably, someone doesn't turn off transmit, and it really confuses the rescuers when one of the rescuers is still on transmit mode. Follow? Okay, digging is critical. Now today with beacons, you can find the victim pretty rapidly, but the digging is what takes the time. So once you locate the victim, stick your probe pole in there and then pull back from where the victim is and start shoveling. In the past, we located the victim and we started shoveling down. We ended up with a funnel, a hole, and here's the victim's leg, and we piled all the snow where the victim's head is. So you want to pull back from where the victim is and start shoveling. You can, if there's only two people, shovel one side, the other person to the other side. If there's many people, develop a conveyor belt to get the snow as far away from where the victim is. Once you've dug down, you roll the victim out and begin first aid. Okay, finally, we don't have Brian here. We're gonna do a just quick practice probe and then we're done. We're just about on time. Who would like to be, usually I pick the typical avalanche victim and I have women do the probing. I'm exhausted guy. Oh, shoot. Come on, you could be a victim, small victim. Okay, so we'll get out here. And we're gonna have,
okay.
Wanna be a prober?
Sure.
Oh, no, I want women.
Sorry. I used to have long hair.
You can probe.
You guys have short hair, but he's picking me.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. So grab, you gotta let, we want to do where people can see.
That was my plan.
How about, why don't you lay down over there? Okay, good. Okay, what we're going to do, there's different ways of probing. I guess we can do it this way.
Ticklish.
Oh, we'll manage here. So you want to be shoulder to shoulder. And I like the shoulder to shoulder spacing because you can always touch your shoulder, so you can always keep your track of your spacing. There's another way to do it where you do elbow to elbow like this, and then you probe once to the right, probe once to the left, and invariably the spacing falls apart. This isn't quite as accurate, but I think in the end it's more accurate because you keep your spacing. It's critical to keep your spacing. So, you probe down, and then you move 2 feet ahead while you aren't, so fake it. Two feet, and then you probe. So, how do we know maybe we found the victim?
There's more resistance. More resistance?
Well, maybe less resistance.
Maybe less, yeah.
You sort of.
Yeah.
Spongy. way,
you hear this?
A good way to get a feeling of what a victim feels like is to probe your friend's tummy. So that will give a good feeling of what a victim feels like. Don't get worried about a puncture wound because, you know, a puncture wound is not as bad as death. Okay? So, another way to identify it is your probes went down deeper, yours didn't. So, what's your name? Which is
Espen.
So Espen is buried 4 feet down. One probe, your probes go down 8 feet. One probe didn't go down as deep. So that's a suspect spot. So what I do is we'd continue probing. You'd stop, mark that spot, call a digger, call Brendan to dig, but you continue probing. Okay. Now, I'm going to...
Do you ever, incorrectly find something and it's like a tree or a branch and it's not?
Oh, well, that could happen.
But...
If it really feels... Of course, it could be a ski or something if it feels just like a branch. So a suspect, I'd dig, but I'd continue probing. Okay. So, it's very easy to keep your spacing when you're going uphill. You know, you walk ahead 2 feet, or and pro, walk 2 feet, pro. When you're going downhill, it's very difficult to keep that spacing. So when I go downhill, I measure 2 feet, I walk up to it, and then pro. Measure 2 feet, walk up, and pro. Okay? I think I covered. We can practice this out on the snow, too. Okay, thank you. I'll, I don't have many. Oh. I got a little smoky pen for the picture. Are you a snowboarder? You will be a snowboarder. Sticker. Okay. So, we got about 11 minutes, enough time for the quiz.
Whoa.
Oh, do we want to do the quiz?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And what we'll do is go it real quickly, and then we'll go over the answers. Okay, we should probably should.
All right.
You're gonna give me the answers. So avalanches are most common on what steepness of slope? 30 to 45 degrees. Good. I have to measure some of the staircases in the hotel to see what's typical, but 38 degrees is optimum. And most staircases are about 38 degrees, so I'll measure one and let everyone know. What clues might help you in recognizing an avalanche slope? Usually that first one's supposed to be without snow, but whatever answers work. So.
Without snow. Okay, I answered it like it was with snow.
Well, that's all right.
How about slope?
So, yes.
Steepness of slope, yes.
Yeah. Debris?
Debris, yes.
Broken tree branches.
So what?
Is it broken?
Broken, yeah, broken.
No limbs on uphill side.
Yes, good, yes, good.
Other avalanches.
Other avalanches, yeah.
It's not debris.
Yeah.
It's different.
Lack of vegetation is a good way to identify an avalanche slope with no snow, whether it's lee, windward, or leeward. Okay. If you saw no signs of an avalanche activity after a storm,
mm-hmm.
would you consider that the slope were safe for travel?
No.
Good. And then, another one, if you go to a particular spot and ski, every year you go to the same spot, you've never seen an avalanche there. Okay? Free for all? No. There's been numerous cases of avalanche fatalities where people have skied or whatever, and, we've never seen an avalanche there. It's happened in Crater Lake National Park where some cross-country skiers, cross-country skiers are lost. The two park rangers mm-hmm. went out after them, released an avalanche, one of the park rangers right near the lodge. Mm-hmm. One of the park rangers was buried, recovered, fortunately, but they'd never, ever seen an avalanche there. Mm-hmm. So, can you name some clues that can help you to determine whether the slope is stable or not? This is sort of, then your slope has to have snow on it. So,
smooth.
It's very smooth, no ripples, indication of lee slope.
You see cracking?
Cracks, yes.
Sun cups? Yes.
Sun cups, yes, yes. A lot of times, and I didn't really talk about this, drastic air temperature changes. Sudden warming is a warning signal. the sun balls, you know, the cartwheels versus the small snowballs. Amount of the new snow, it could snow all night in very little wind, and you only have a few inches of new snow versus a storm where it puts 3 feet of new snow, significant difference in danger. Okay, collapse noise. A sudden whoop sound, indication of what?
Extreme
instability. Any of you ever heard those whoops out there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's an indication of one of those weak layers collapsing under the stress you're putting on it by skiing or whatever, snowshoeing. Seeing tracks of wet snowballs rolling down a slope on a warm spring day is usually a sign that the slope is stable.
False.
Depends on the size, right? Yeah, the school book answer is false, but like I mentioned, if the snowballs are small, I'm not too concerned. The slope is tempting to stabilize itself, but I'm not too concerned. If we had those large cartwheels, then I am concerned. Okay, one member of your party traveling across a potential avalanche slope starts a small avalanche, which breaks below him. The rest of the party should follow him quickly across the slope before it again becomes unstable. True or false?
False.
Springtime. South-facing slopes become less dangerous than north-facing slopes because the warming action of the snow stabilizes the snowpack. School book answers false, but it all depends. You know, nothing's perfect. In the middle of the day, that slope might be very unstable. Early in the morning, it refroze by radiation cooling at night, and it's hard as rock. So, most avalanches in the U.S. that involve people are triggered by whom?
The victim.
The chance of survival after being totally buried in an avalanche drop below 50% after
30 minutes.
More people die in avalanches where?
Backcountry.
Most people caught in avalanches die from?
Suffocation.
Suffocation, right. About 75%. 23% by trauma, 2% hypothermia. What are things you and members of your party can do to ensure a safe crossing of an avalanche path?
Don't.
Good one. Yeah, don't.
One at a time.
Good.
Safe zones.
What?
Safe zones.
Safe island.
Yeah, go from island safe to island safe. I think it's also look for an escape route. If it starts to go, where are you going to go? Loosen your equipment. Make sure your beacon's on transmit mode. Okay. Upon being caught in an avalanche, what are some things you can do or should do? Help yourself.
Swim. Fight for the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fight. Stay to the top. Go to the flanks. Try to get to the flanks. If you stay on the edges, it's much less traumatic. If you're in the middle, you're going to be buried in the most debris. So try to stay in the flanks. Grab a hold of something. Now, like in the film last night, Sam grabbed a hold of a tree, but he got pulled right away from it. But anyhow, try to grab a hold of something. It might not work.
Take off gear.
Yeah, get rid of your gear. Good.
If you can't swim, get your hands up to your neck or your face.
Yes, good. And then once you come to a stop, a lot of people, once they came to a stop, stuck a hand up, and their hands were sticking out of the snow. Average depth of burial is about 4.5 feet. So, depending on how your position, you might be fairly close to the surface. Okay, can you rank in order of importance? Watch it. The things you should do if someone in your party is caught in a backcountry avalanche. What is always number one?
Ensure the safety of party members.
Yes, yes, good. Now, ensure the safety of surviving members. Number two, then.
Well, nowadays, call for help.
Well, call for help. Yeah, I had marked, actually.
So, mark the spot.
I had marked the spot. That's critical. Mark it, because if it's snowing, you might lose that spot. So mark the spot, last seen area. Look for clues, probe, go for, last resort is go for help. Because most cases, you go for help, too late, by the time help gets back. So that'd be last resort. You know, number one, if you got cell phones, call 911. You're starting out on a winter backcountry trip with three friends, an hour and a half from the car. One of your friends is buried in an avalanche. After a quick search of the area, reviews no clues, you should send two people to summon help while a third continues the search. I already gave you the answer. False. After course probing an area once, you should begin the fine probing. Forget about that. What we're demonstrating here is course probing. Fine probing is essentially just for body recovery. I'd continue the course probing, what we demonstrated here. Okay. One last thing and then we're done. If I can find it. This information came from a jet bomber pilot who survived many trips. And he said, know the enemy, know yourself and what you're, number one, know yourself and what you're willing to risk. Two, know the enemy. Three, never attack on anything but on your own terms. Four, have the ability to avoid temptation. Five, always have an exit and use it when you're winning. So, constantly looking for escape zones. When it happens, maybe it's too late to look for an escape zone. Six, which I've added, if one in the group has concerns, let that be the group guide. So if someone in the group has some concerns about going any further, go with that. Go with minority opinion. Go home. And number seven then, there's always a tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Yay.